10 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is Julian Potter with Newsdesk. The headlines this hour: the Indonesian authorities have said they're acting to restore order in East Timor, where days of bloodshed by anti-independence militias have left the capital, Dili, in ruins. Palestinian prisoners have been celebrating their release by Israel, the first tangible result of the latest peace agreement. And a report commissioned by the British government has recommended controversial changes to the police force in Northern Ireland, a move that's aroused strong opposition from Protestant unionists. Among our other reports, Russian officials say they can't rule out the possibility that a devastating explosion in Moscow may have been caused by a bomb. And mayors from 50 American cities are in Washington to lobby the President and Congress for tighter gun controls. The Indonesian government has again rejected the idea of an international peacekeeping force for East Timor and says it can restore order itself following days of violence involving militias opposed to independence. The Indonesian Foreign Minister Ali Alatas said the imposition of martial law 2 days ago was having an effect, though he also said that what he called rogue elements within the security forces had been involved in the destruction. He was speaking after talks in Jakarta between a UN Security Council mission and President Habibie. The leader of the UN delegation said it intended to visit East Timor on Saturday. Jonathan Head reports. We'll come back to that report. Hopefully we get Jonathan Head back on the line. Meanwhile, at an emergency meeting in New Zealand, foreign ministers from around the world called on Indonesia to restore peace to the territory. The United States and Britain joined Asian and Pacific countries in offering to contribute to an international force if Indonesia was willing to accept one. The chairman of the meeting, the New Zealand Foreign Minister Don McKinnon, said the solution lay in the hands of the United Nations and Indonesia. From the New Zealand city of Auckland, Jill McGivering reports.
Mr. McKinnon emerged from the meeting to place a strong emphasis on the consensus he said was achieved there and to minimise speculation about divisions within the region on how to handle the East Timor issue. The real business of resolution belonged not to Auckland, he said, but to New York and the United Nations. But he emphasised international willingness to provide whatever support was needed.
We're still horrified at the continuing violence in East Timor, the activities of the militia, even with martial law that's being imposed, there's still no real improvement. So this issue in East Timor is really, it's got bigger than our ministerial meeting, it's bigger than APEC. It really has to be once again readdressed by the Security Council, and we all have to do our best in this region to ensure that Indonesia will find it acceptable for the greater UN presence in Timor.
British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, who flew to Auckland to attend the meeting on behalf of the United Kingdom and the European Union, said three clear messages had emerged from Thursday's meeting. The best outcome, he said, was still for Indonesia to restore order, either acting alone or with the help of the international community if it requested that. He said the fact that so many countries had been represented at the meeting, either by foreign ministers or senior officials, showed the enormous degree of international concern about the violence and brutality in East Timor. The recent vote by the East Timorese was a clear cry for freedom, he added, which the world now expected to be translated into reality. The message to those involved in the violence was that they wouldn't succeed in standing in the way of democratic forces, and he called on the army of Indonesia to accept the policy of the government of Indonesia on the issue.
Jill McGivering in New Zealand. While the diplomacy continues, some organisations have already started to talk about direct action. In Australia, trade unions have launched a campaign for peace. Bill Mansfield is the Assistant Secretary of the Australian Council of Trades Unions.
The Australian trade union movement has committed itself to put bans on Indonesian interests in Australia. And we're hoping that we'll see similar bans placed by other trade union movements around the world. What we're seeing is that the Maritime Union will refuse to handle cargo to and from Indonesia. The airline unions will refuse to handle cargo in the same way. The telephone and postal services will be affected. Municipal services will be affected, and things of that kind.
Bill Mansfield, the Assistant Secretary of the Australian Council of Trades Unions. Well, let's go back to our main story, that the Indonesian government has again rejected the idea of an international peacekeeping force for East Timor and says it can restore order itself following the days of violence involving militias opposed to independence. We have on the line now from Jakarta, Jonathan Head.
The decision by the Indonesian authorities to allow a UN team into East Timor is at least the first indication that Jakarta recognises the need for some international assistance to stop the destruction in the territory. But Indonesian ministers still insist they won't allow an outside peacekeeping force into East Timor. The fact that the besieged UN mission in Dili has also decided to stay on, despite shortages of food and water, will keep a symbolic international presence there. The head of mission, Ian Martin, told the BBC that shooting continued on the streets of Dili, but that he had reached an agreement with the military to move more than 1,000 refugees to a safe area inside the territory. In another concession, Indonesia's Foreign Minister Ali Alatas admitted for the first time that Indonesian troops had been involved in the orgy of killing and looting which has engulfed East Timor. Indonesia does now seem to understand the enormous damage done to its reputation by the behaviour of its forces in East Timor. But the government of President Habibie has been severely weakened by the violence and may yet find it difficult to rein in the military. Tens of thousands of East Timorese have now been forcibly moved to other islands. Aid agencies are finding it difficult to get access to them. No one yet knows how many people have been killed over the past few days of terror. Now back to the studio.
That was Jonathan Head in Jakarta. Well, with Indonesia rejecting international pressure to allow the deployment of a peacekeeping force in East Timor, the situation on the ground continues to worsen. Nonetheless, the international community seems to have little option but to hope that the Indonesian military itself can restore order. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Marcus contrasts the crisis in East Timor with the willingness of a NATO-led coalition to initiate military action in Kosovo.
The NATO-led air campaign against Serbia was seen by many commentators as establishing a precedent in international relations. The willingness of a group of countries to act against another state to halt the brutal suppression of an ethnic group within its own borders. Now a similar crisis on the other side of the world is testing this new approach. In Kosovo, NATO acted to halt the onslaught by Serbian troops and paramilitary units against ethnic Albanians, who it insisted should have a large measure of autonomy within Yugoslavia. In East Timor, it is not autonomy, but independence that is the issue. The international community, and seemingly the Indonesian government as well, accepting the proposition that it is up to the ordinary people of the region to chart their own political future. But this, of course, is not how elements of the Indonesian military see things. And this is what makes the whole debate about outside intervention so complex. The international community wants to see the government in Jakarta as part of the solution to this crisis. But many independent analysts believe that elements of the military are actually supporting the anti-independence militias. Thus, it is not clear what an intervention force would have to do and who it would be up against. Factors which must be clear before any operation can be mounted. East Timor differs from Kosovo in two other key respects. In Kosovo, NATO went ahead irrespective of the United Nations wishes. In East Timor, a UN-backed force is seen as essential. And in Kosovo, it was a very particular sort of war, intervention from the air, from afar. Whereas in East Timor, any peace-enforcing mission would have to go in on the ground.
Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. You're listening to Newsdesk from the BBC World Service. Palestinians released from Israeli prisons have been celebrating their return home in the first tangible sign of progress in the Middle East peace process since the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak came to power. Buses took the first batch of around 200 Palestinians who had to sign a pledge renouncing violence from prisons in Israel to Gaza and the West Bank. Hilary Anderson reports from Jerusalem.
There were scenes of great joy as the prisoners were bused into Gaza with relatives singing and chanting with emotion. Palestinian flags were raised high and the crowd surged forward as the buses of prisoners arrived. There were also scenes of disappointment. Some had expected their sons and brothers to be freed, but they were not. Today, 199 prisoners have been freed. These are the first of a total of 350 prisoners who are to be freed in all, in line with the peace agreement signed between the Israelis and the Palestinians last weekend. Some of the prisoners who've been freed complained that their friends have been left behind. The prisoner release issue has become a highly controversial one, with many Palestinians complaining that the numbers being released are too few. Amongst the Israeli right wing, the issue is also controversial. Many fear that the releases will jeopardize the security of the Israeli state. But Israel's new Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, said yesterday that Israel's democratic values dictated the need for change. Today's prisoner releases will soon be followed by land handovers from the Israelis to the Palestinians, both critical first steps on Ehud Barak's new road to peace.
Hilary Anderson in Jerusalem. Moscow authorities investigating a powerful explosion which destroyed a block of flats in the capital overnight say they cannot exclude the possibility of a bomb. The Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin said the most probable cause was a gas explosion, adding that all leads were being followed. At least 15 bodies have been recovered and over 100 people rescued. About 60 of them, including several children, were taken to hospital. James Rogers has this report from Moscow.
Hundreds of firefighters and rescue workers are involved in the operation in Gurianov Street in the southeast of the city. Excavation equipment and sniffer dogs are being used to try to locate anyone who might still be alive in the rubble. Machinery is being shut down periodically to allow the emergency services to listen for any sign of life in the ruins. The explosion happened just after midnight. The blast tore through the nine-story block of flats, destroying the homes of some 200 people. Because of the time of the explosion, most residents were at home, many in bed. One man who was escorted to safety from the scene said it was as if the building had been cut with a knife. The cause of the blast is not yet known, but the Ministry of Emergency Situations says that indications so far suggest it may have been a gas leak. A thorough investigation is underway alongside the rescue effort. Senior officials, including cabinet ministers and the mayor of Moscow, have visited the scene to see the operation at first hand. With many people still unaccounted for, rescue workers fear the death toll will continue to rise.
James Rogers in Moscow. A government-commissioned report is being published in Britain recommending a radical overhaul in the policing of Northern Ireland. The changes are in response to long-standing criticism by Republicans that the police force is overwhelmingly Protestant and strongly identified with the pro-unionists who want Northern Ireland to remain part of Britain. The report, drawn up under the chairmanship of the former governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, will, among other things, propose a name change from the existing Royal Ulster Constabulary. John Devitt reports.
The key thrust of this report, according to Chris Patten, is to take politics out of policing so that the Northern Ireland police force can be acceptable to every part of the community. At the moment, many nationalists who oppose British rule believe the present force, the RUC, operates for unionists who wish to retain links with Britain, and very few people from the nationalist community have joined the RUC. The Patten report recommends changing the image of the RUC by changing its name and dropping many of the symbols that traditionally link it to Britain. A new recruitment policy will be designed to make the force more representative. The report also attempts to make the new police service more accountable. A new police authority, which will include members of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, will oversee the force. Local councillors will have a greater input. Mr. Patten insisted, though, that the changes wouldn't mean that paramilitaries could become police officers, and he was confident that the proposals would be generally accepted.
It has been our strong sense throughout the past 15 months that the majority are determined that life here should be transformed, and that in spite of the difficulties of moving forward, things must not be allowed to go back to the way they were.
Even so, there's already been strong criticism from unionist politicians. Mr. Patten accepted that the implementation of this report depends on the continuation of the political process, which has stalled, and the assumption that the security situation doesn't deteriorate.
John Devitt. This is Newsdesk from the BBC World Service in London. Later in the programme, news of a new internet website sponsored by the United Nations that aims to fight poverty and hunger worldwide. But first, a reminder of our top story this hour. The Indonesian government has again rejected the idea of an international peacekeeping force for East Timor and says it can restore order itself following days of violence involving militias opposed to independence. The Indonesian Foreign Minister, Ali Alatas, said the imposition of martial law 2 days ago was having an effect, though he also said that what he called rogue elements within the security forces had been involved in the destruction. at emergency talks in New Zealand, a meeting of foreign ministers from around the world called on Indonesia to resolve the conflict in East Timor and offered to contribute an international force. In Iran, a new daily newspaper has appeared on the streets following the closure of a pro-reform newspaper on Sunday by a special press court in Tehran. The new publication, Abara Ektasad, is being run by the same journalists who were publishing the newspaper Neshat, which was accused of insulting Islam and the position of the country's supreme leader. Our Middle East correspondent Jim Muir reports.
When Neshat disappeared from the streets on Sunday, the journalists and publishers producing it vowed they would challenge the closure ordered by the conservative-led special press court. They're still hoping that the ban will be lifted when the case gets a hearing. But in the meantime, they're bringing out yet another reformist publication, Akhbar-e-Iqtisad, which reached the newsstands on Thursday. This is the third time in little more than a year that the same group of reform-minded journalists have brought out a new publication to replace titles shut down by the judiciary, which has often been accused by the reformists of playing a factional political role on behalf of the hardline conservatives. Neshat was ordered shut down by the special press court on Saturday after being accused of insulting the tenets of Islam and the position of the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It had published an article which was seen as questioning one of the foundations of Iranian justice, the Islamic principle of retribution, or an eye for an eye. It had also carried an open letter to the supreme leader from a veteran opposition politician asking him to rise above factional politics in the run-up to next February's crucial parliamentary elections.
Jim Muir reporting. Reports from Burma say that the streets of the capital Rangoon have been deserted despite a call by dissidents for people to organise protests against the military government. There was heavy security throughout the city, with schools and many shops closed. The dissidents had chosen today, the ninth day of the ninth month, 1999, to recall protests on the eighth day of the eighth month in 1988, when hundreds of demonstrators were killed. Burmese exiles, however, did stage protests. Some 50 protesters broke into Burma's Canberra-based embassy in Australia, and there was a noisy demonstration in Bangkok, as Charlotte Bevan reports.
Clutching pictures of Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, student activists called for an end to the country's brutal military regime. One group cut their arms with razor blades, dripped the blood onto a piece of paper marked with the acronym for Burma's ruling State Peace and Development Council, or SPDC, and burnt it.
I want to achieve inside Burma to develop democracy and human rights and civil government, because there is no civil government in Burma.
Buddhist monks and foreign refugee workers were also among the demonstrators.
I have worked in Chile for 10 years during the Pinochet regime. That was a very repressive regime that tried to eliminate any free-thinking liberal left thought in that nation. This is worse because it is out to do an ethnic cleansing as well as do away with any political party or any free political thinking.
Exiled student activists and dissidents hope that their calls for democracy will echo across Burma itself and inspire civil unrest. In recent weeks, they've been distributing leaflets inside the country urging people to call a general strike and to boycott the state media. But despite reports of isolated protests over the past few days, hopes for a mass movement that will mirror events of 11 years ago seemed unlikely to come to fruition. Analysts believe a climate of fear and increasing security by the military will prevent people taking to the streets. Authorities have also cornered off roads where activists historically have gathered.
Charlotte Bevan reporting from Bangkok. You're listening to News Desk from the BBC World Service. It's 19 minutes past 10, Greenwich Mean Time. President Yeltsin has denied any personal involvement in allegations of money laundering and corruption during a telephone conversation with President Clinton. Aides to President Clinton said the Russian leader also promised his government would help with the US investigation into the allegations. From Washington, here's our correspondent Rob Watson.
Alleged corruption in Russia from President Yeltsin on down has been big news in the US. 2 weeks ago, the New York Times reported that billions of dollars had been laundered by Russians through the Bank of New York. Now, the Washington Post is alleging there is evidence to suggest that President Yeltsin himself received money from a Swiss contractor doing building works at the Kremlin. The whole issue has now been raised in an hour-long telephone conversation between President Yeltsin and President Clinton, during which, according to the U.S. National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, the Russian leader offered cooperation and denials.
He indicated that the government of Russia would cooperate with these investigations. He suggested that, at least in part, there may be some political motivations in his own country that affected these allegations. And Yeltsin denied those reports.
Mr. Berger said President Clinton had told President Yeltsin how important it was to deal with the allegations on their merits and to cooperate.
Rob Watson in Washington. Four aspiring presidential candidates from Mexico's governing Institutional Revolutionary Party have taken part in a public debate for the first time in the party's 70 years of unbroken rule. Until now, the serving president has always chosen his successor. But now primary elections will decide which candidate represents the party in next year's presidential poll. As our correspondent Peter Grester reports, the debate, broadcast live on national television, is part of a new experience in Mexican democracy.
For millions of Mexicans, Wednesday night's debate was a new experience. Never before have they had the spectacle of the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party's presidential hopefuls sparring with one another in public, and certainly never live on television. Until now, the party's president has always nominated his successor, virtually guaranteeing that that candidate would take over the country's top job. The party, known as the PRI, has ruled Mexico for 70 years non-stop, and it's often been described as the world's most efficient election-winning machine, taking on whatever shape is necessary to win the next election. In this latest guise, the PRI has scrapped the old nomination process, which kept internal struggles hidden from public view. Instead, it's replaced it with its first open primary election, including Wednesday's public debate. The strictly controlled format allowed little room for sparring, but that didn't stop the two leading candidates from taking stinging shots at one another. The former governor of the state of Tabasco, Roberto Madrazo, who's leading the polls, frankly declared that as Mexico enters the 21st century, half of the population is living in the 19th century. The former interior minister, Francisco Labastida, who's widely seen as the serving president Ernesto Zedillo's favorite, countered by promising to make profound changes to the way the country is run.
Peter Grester in Mexico City. The mayors of 50 American cities, accompanied by their police chiefs, will visit Washington today to lobby the president and Congress for tighter gun control. The bill they want passed would ensure background checks for anyone buying a weapon at a gun show. But the draft law is currently held up in Congress. One of the mayors taking part, Clarence Harmon of St. Louis in Missouri, explains what he hopes the mission will achieve.
In this country, we have such a long and historic relationship, almost a paranoia about guns on the one hand and a love affair with them on the other hand. And it is difficult, I think, to pass any kind of gun control legislation per se. What our effort, quite frankly, is to get sensible things passed, and yet for the vast majority of people who use guns safely, still permit access to them for sports shooting purposes, hunting, and collecting of firearms.
Clarence Harmon, the mayor of St. Louis in Missouri. A summit of African leaders in Libya is due to adopt proposals today aimed at revitalizing Africa's economic potential. The changes being discussed include the possible creation of new trading blocs similar to the European Union. Changes to the constitution of the Organization of African Unity are also under review. In a speech to the summit, the Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi demanded veto rights for Africa on the United Nations Security Council. The Algerian president, Abdel Aziz Bouteflika, warned that the continent couldn't move forward so long as conflicts continued to rage across it. More evidence is emerging that the world's second largest economy, Japan, is emerging from recession. With more on this and other finance news, here's Wendy Pascoe of our business staff.
The value of the goods and services Japan sells, also known as its output, rose again in the 3 months to June, this time by 0.2%. Economists had been predicting a contraction. The figures will also be welcomed elsewhere. Many countries, particularly in Asia, rely on demand in Japan for their own economic prosperity. One of those nations is Indonesia, where events in East Timor are continuing to dominate the news. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have made veiled threats to cut off aid unless the Indonesian government takes steps to reimpose order in East Timor. Professor Michael Liefer is the director of the Asian Research Centre at the London School of Economics.
If the effect of sanctions, namely withholding the tranche from the International Monetary Fund, is to cause a dramatic decline in the rupiah, for example, and to bring about a further decline in economic activity with increasing unemployment, then the general condition of Indonesia may be such that the stake that external Western governments have in the country could well be undermined. In other words, Indonesia's very weakness and precariousness actually serves as an impediment to the imposition of economic sanctions.
That was Professor Michael Liefer from the London School of Economics. The markets now, London's 100 share index is currently just 4.5 up at 6258.1. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei index was just 36 high at 17,677, barely moved despite those GDP figures. Currencies now, the dollar is trading at 109 Japanese yen, the euro $1.5.9, the pound is at $1.62.
Wendy Pascoe. Sport now. Australia's cricketers have been struggling on the opening day of the first test against Sri Lanka. And in tennis, the home favourite Andre Agassi is through to the semi-finals of the US Open. With more details, Joe Parsons.
The World Cup holders Australia made a dismal start to the opening test in their three-match series in Sri Lanka. Michael Slater, Greg Blewett and Shane Warne all failed to score as Australia were bowled out for 188 shortly after tea on the first day in Kandy. Ricky Ponting hit 96 and Jason Gillespie scored a career-best 41. For Sri Lanka, Muthiah Muralitharan took four wickets and there were three each for Chaminda Vass and Nuwan Zoysa. A short while ago, Sri Lanka were 15 for no wicket in reply. In tennis, the semi-final lineup has been decided for the women's singles at the US Open, and Andre Agassi is through to play Yevgeny Kafelnikov in the last four of the men's singles. Reporting from New York, Barry Milnes.
They came out in large numbers and Andre Agassi didn't disappoint. But initially, the American favourite had to work very hard to get the better of French qualifier Nicolas Escudé. On a muggy night, under the lights, the first set went with serve to a tiebreak before the American turned up the gas on his ground strokes and took it 7-3. From there, he won the next two sets, 6-3, 6-4, to go through to another US Open semi-final. The American now faces Russia's Yevgeny Kafelnikov, who won a five-set thriller against Richard Krajicek 7-6 in the last set, that despite a world record 49 aces from the Dutchman. 17-year-old Serena Williams joined elder sister Venus in the semi-finals of a Grand Slam for the first time by overcoming Monica Seles 4-6, 6-3, 6-2. And standing between Serena and the final, defending champion Lindsay Davenport, who had to save two match points before beating Mary Pierce of France 6-2, 3-6, 7-5.
Barry Milnes reporting. And finally in football, Jamaica and the United States drew 2-2 in a friendly international in Kingston, and Trinidad and Tobago beat Colombia 4-3 at the Orange Bowl in Miami.
Joe Parsons with the sports news. President Clinton, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Nelson Mandela have joined in a simultaneous international launch of a new internet website that aims to fight poverty and hunger worldwide. The NetAid site, sponsored by the United Nations Development Programme, wants to make it as easy as possible for donors to give time or money. Next month, NetAid hopes to raise millions of dollars for anti-poverty programmes. To end the edition of Newsdesk now, the main points again. Foreign ministers from around the world have called on Indonesia to restore peace to East Timor, where hundreds of civilians are known to have been killed and tens of thousands of people have fled. The United States and Britain joined Asian and Pacific countries at emergency talks in New Zealand, pledging support for United Nations efforts to end the crisis. Palestinians released from Israeli prisons have been celebrating their return home in the first tangible sign of progress in the Middle East peace process since the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak came to power. And Russian officials say they cannot rule out the possibility that a devastating explosion in Moscow may have been caused by a bomb. But they said the most likely cause was that the blast, which killed at least 15 people, was a gas explosion. I'm Julian Potter. You've been listening to Newsdesk.